It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and Strange Champs is out this week. I'm Sarah Nix. With all the talk about podcasts, we're wondering about the future of listening. Where else to start but with the sound of cereal? More precisely, it's the sound of a podcast listening party. One December afternoon, a bunch of people gathered in a conference room to listen to the final episode of the breakout hit podcast, Cereal. It's not actually about breakfast foods, but anyhow. It was launched last fall by some producers from This American Life, and by the end of its 12-episode run, it had been heard more than 5 million times through iTunes alone.
And it's become this phenomenon. There are listening parties all over the country.
Sitting in that conference room felt a bit like being in one of those old photographs. You know, the ones where there's a family gathered in the parlor to listen to a radio drama.
So I'll just start here.
We don't really do that anymore. Now people are more likely to obsess about the next season of Game of Thrones or Sherlock, which they can watch when they like, thanks to streaming services like Netflix. That on-demand streaming is available for audio, too, and it could be that listening is again becoming central to our lives. Unlike traditional broadcast radio, smartphones and podcasts make it possible for us to hear what we want, when we want. And some people are placing their bets on the power of podcasting.
Good morning, Sarah.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
That's Alex Blumberg. You may know him from such shows as This American Life and Planet Money. Last year, he left his job in public radio to launch a podcast production business. I wanted to talk to him about why he's setting out on his own and about the Cereal effect.
From where we thought we were 3 months ago to where we are now, everything is different. Like, Cereal has done so much work to raise the profile of podcasting. And now, like, you know, there's a hashtag after Cereal. There's now, I don't know, a couple million people who know about podcasts who didn't know about them before and are looking for things to listen to. So we feel like we should try to meet that new demand more quickly than we had originally imagined.
So,
right?
so let us back up.
Yeah.
And can you please explain what you're setting out to do?
I'm setting out to launch a media company focusing on narrative audio, journalism, as well as other kinds of narrative audio programming. I guess, you know, I worked for a long time at This American Life. And then while at This American Life, I co-founded Planet Money, which is a podcast about business and economics. And I ran Planet Money for a long time, for several years at NPR. And I had a chance to observe sort of what was happening with the podcasts, you know, at Planet Money and at This American Life. The podcasts of those shows were growing tremendously and attracting new listeners every day, every month. Ad revenues were increasing and just sort of excitement in general was increasing about it, about the form. Creatively, it feels like wonderful and sort of like expansive in a way that, you know, a new medium, I guess, sort of feels like. And it's very popular. Like, people are adopting it at rapid rates. So we should make more of this kind of programming. So that was the original idea for the company, is sort of raise some money and start creating programs.
So you're starting this business, and at the same time, you're making a podcast about starting the business. It's called Startup. And there's this great moment in it when your partner, Matt Lieber, is explaining to some potential investors what a podcast is, because not everybody knows. Let's listen to that.
Podcasts, what they are is they are digital audio files that you download from typically straight to either to your computer and then to your phone or straight to your phone now. So
are they always recorded or are they ever broadcast live?
By nature recorded because it's a discrete file that you download.
But everyone in the group was familiar with radio, both public radio and other examples of broadcasting excellence, namely Howard Stern. By the way, that's what's so great about podcasting. It's the same thing that Howard Stern has grown into, like, whatever it is, $500 million contract with Sirius. It's like that intimacy. Like, you're there with him. You're having this really intimate conversation with
him. Was that, coming from a public radio background, kind of a reality check for you? Did you assume that everybody kind of knew what a podcast was?
Intellectually, I knew that not everybody knew what a podcast was. And intellectually, I knew that there were lots of people out there for whom this was a totally foreign concept. But yeah, it was a bit of a reality check. It was just one reality check among, you know, sort of several hundred that were happening every single day. But yes.
Right. Well, so what kind of research and how do you even go about researching the potential growth of podcast listenership? You must believe that there are a host of ears out there waiting for good content. They just don't know it yet.
Yeah. So what you do is you take data that's out there and then you try to extrapolate trends from that data. And the data that we knew about were, you know, sort of like domestically in the United States, how many people listen to the radio? And it's a lot. It's like 240 million people listen every week. They listen for 10 to 12 hours a week. And then you extrapolate. So, you know, so most of that listening happens in cars. But as cars become more capable of playing on-demand digital, you figure like some percentage of those people are going to start listening on-demand, the same thing that's happening in TV. And then you add on top of that the fact that now everybody in the world essentially has a smartphone or an audio-capable phone anyway. And we're all walking around with earbuds wherever we go. So there's all this additional time that is available for listening that wasn't before. So that was sort of, it wasn't like we had hard data. We had a story that we believed that was constructed from data.
And so if you were to project out like 5 years, what do you see as the podcast listener numbers?
In the U.S. alone, I hesitate to say, but right now it's something like, I don't know, 40 million people have listened to a podcast. I don't know. In 5 years, could that double? I think easily.
So, you know, about 10 years ago, not quite 10 years ago, I was working for a little public radio station in Maine, and I did this story about podcasting along the lines of like, wow, there's this thing people are doing in their basements and they're making a living at it. And they were probably making a couple $1,000 a month, maybe,
right,
in ad revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably still true for a lot of podcasts out there. I mean, a lot of those original 10-year-old podcasts are still new episodes are being put out. But that kind of $2,000 a month thing is not what you're talking about, right?
No. I think some of those podcasts have grown into legitimate businesses in an enterprise that employs people and pays healthcare. And I think, you know, sort of one of the quintessential stories along those lines is Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible.
And his podcast is a kind of about design in our lives.
It's about design. It's sort of a story narrative-based podcast about design. It's really cool. Like, it's a great podcast, but also it is the example of sort of like a guy who started in his basement or whatever and has grown this enterprise into not like a huge thing, but like he's got a staff now of a couple people and they're paying, you know, they have salaries and they have benefits and I would imagine that it's going to continue to grow. And my hope was to sort of like be an incubator for people like that and help get their audiences bigger so that you don't have to take 5 years to do it, but we'll pay you the salary right now and we'll grow it together. You know, we can sort of do it in a matter of months, get to that sort of level. And if we do that a bunch of times, then we're talking about a fairly large scale business.
Yeah. And one of the things that, going back to that story about discovering podcasts 9 years ago, when I imagine the majority of podcasts out there, I don't think of Roman Mars. I think of poorly recorded idle conversations that are not terribly interesting, and
mm-hmm.
people seem to really want higher quality podcasts. How much is that quality control, that production value, part of what you're setting out to do?
Oh, I mean, that's our entire strategy. We're doing something that I don't think anybody really is doing in the space right now, which is for our first three shows, we come out of the gate with a staff of three people, you know, and we put an editorial system in place where we go through several edits before they come out. And the editorial side to me is the most important thing.
So the kinds of stories you're telling and how you're telling them.
The kinds of stories we're telling and how we're telling them and sort of the care we're taking to sort of craft them into things that are engaging to as wide an audience as possible. And it seems like the market rewards the highly produced, highly edited ones. Like if you look at the top of iTunes, most of them are ones that people have put a lot of thought into creating the content. And those are the ones that are rewarded with a large audience. So that's also sort of the bet we're making, is that if we put a lot of time and effort and care into crafting our shows and thinking about them editorially, that we will be rewarded with audience.
So you believe the audience potential is out there? The other basic business plan question, I guess, is competition. I mean, who do you see as competition for listeners?
Well, right now, I don't see anybody as competition because
wow.
I feel like we're in the very, and honestly, like we're in the very beginning here where if I'm right and the audience grows from 40 million to 80 million, there is plenty to go around. We are nowhere near saturated. So let's just take the print journalism world, you know, and compare it to audio. You know, in print journalism, you have newspapers, you have magazines, you have specialty magazines, you have women's magazines, men's magazines, you have sports magazines, you have auto magazines. And in every category, you have 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 different entrants. And then let's look at audio. You have essentially 1 or 2 national newspapers in you know, NPR and Marketplace and a couple of these other ones. And then you have like...
Slate.
Yeah. And then you have a couple of like... you know, policy discussion shows, and then you have like a couple of sort of the equivalent of like a magazine, and then you don't really have anything else. There's like music shows, but there's not like a music journalism narrative audio product. You know what I mean? I think there's a lot of opportunity, and I think 10 years from now, 12 years from now, I think, you know, we'll be in the world that the print world is in right now, where like one of the only ways to find your own audience is to steal it from somebody else. But I don't think we're there yet in audio.
Well, and public radio is getting into the podcast game. Not only are public radio stations podcasting shows that they're already airing, but they're also launching podcast-only programs. Are they competition for you, or do you, again, just feel like there's so much space, I'm not worried?
I feel like there's so much space, I'm not worried. I think they're going to find listeners who have never heard of podcasting, and those listeners are going to be like, oh, I like this podcast, I'm looking for other ones. And then those people will discover us, and we'll do the same for other people. You know, we're all just trying to like say, hey, there's this thing out here, and you guys should all check it out. And the more of us doing good stuff there is, the better that is for all of us.
That's Alex Bloomberg, the podcast he's making about launching a podcast production company. It's called Startup. So what does all the buzz about podcasts mean for you? You, listening to this show right now. If Alex Bloomberg is right and commercial podcasts are about to explode, how will that change what you hear on your favorite public radio station? We turn to this guy for some insight.
I'm Chris Bannon. I am Vice President of Content Production and Development for WNYC here in New York, and I manage some of our terrestrial radio shows and the development and production of many of our podcasts.
Over the past year, Chris Bannon's station has launched 3 new podcast-only programs. You can't tune them in on your radio dial. He's also taken in 2 other podcasts that were started independently. So he seemed like just the person to ask about what podcasting means for public radio.
I think podcasting has been the best thing to happen to public radio in my lifetime. So by launching something as a podcast, it's actually much easier to get off the ground. You start with someone who has an idea, or perhaps even an existing podcast that has just, they've just reached a point at which they need the help of an institution like WNYC. For instance, with The Longest Shortest Time, we approached Hillary Frank, who had a podcast every other week about parenting, and she didn't have a full-time producer. It had reached a sort of point at which marketing and promotion would really help it grow, and we wanted to have a podcast project that would serve the audience that she was talking to.
This is The Longest Shortest Time. I'm Hillary Frank. I started recording this podcast in my bedroom 4 years ago after a pretty rough childbirth experience. I started the show because I needed to connect with other moms. It was just amazing how many of you wanted to tell your stories on this show or just said that the stories were making you feel less alone too. Then WNYC picked up the show in May and made this an actual sustainable project. And I feel so lucky that I get the chance to tell your stories and help you to connect with each other. So thank you for that.
I don't see independent producers as competitors of ours, primarily because I believe the potential appeal of all the audio being made right now, I think, is still untapped. There was a survey this summer by Edison Research. They looked at the listening habits of several thousand people over the course of a day, everything from radio in your car to radio at home to podcasts. And on that day this summer, I think only 4% of listening was done to podcasts, which to me means we have 96% of listening that's up for grabs. I mean, we know people will continue to listen to the radio, but WNYC needs to think about its digital audience. the number of people who listen to our podcasts, Radiolab and Freakonomics Radio, Studio 360 on the media, millions and millions of downloads a month. We reach about a million plus people on WNYC AM and FM here in New York, but we're in fact really broadcasting now to a global audience. When I look at the future, and when I look at a show that's in development now, I don't actually think about whether or not it's going to be a radio show necessarily first or a podcast first. However, I do think, and we've done this, shows that start as podcasts can become radio shows. Freakonomics Radio started as a podcast.
Hey, Freakonomics.
Is a college education still worth it?
Should tipping be banned?
How many parking spaces are there?
Why do drug dealers live in
a— Hey, Freakonomics, I have a question for you.
The difference in tone between podcasts and terrestrial radio shows is actually one of the most exciting things for me, because I think it's much more informal than public radio has become.
I was like, does he want to kiss me? Like, I can't kiss this guy. He doesn't have his stuff together. Like,
it's much more spontaneous. Some people may say, well, it's more crude. You can hear the edits. It's not so highly polished. But I think the unscripted nature of a lot of it makes it more exciting to listen to.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
It was such a sad, pathetic transition point in my life, but it really was one where I was like, okay, I have not had my stuff together, but you're giving me a chance.
I mean, I could tell. I was like, oh, he went out and bought new bedding. Like,
if you listen to commercial terrestrial radio, it's already really informal. For public radio, I do think we'll be looking at ways to introduce that kind of spontaneity and sense of fun into the work that we do without, I hope, losing our reputation for providing you with reliable, smart information, things you can use in your everyday life. All the things that we talk about during pledge drives for public radio, I hope will still be true as we enter, you know, a world that's primarily digital. In a way, we have found ourselves back in the middle of people's lives, just the way radio has been for almost a century. It's just that now there's a brand new tool, the smartphone, that makes it very, very easy for people to access our content.
That's Chris Bannon. He's VP of Production, Content, and Development at WNYC in New York. You can find an extended version of our conversation with him on our website. That's ttbook.org. And while you're there, look for the big button on our homepage and start getting the podcast version of this show. I'm Sarah Nix, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Starting around the year 2000, radio stations began streaming their broadcasts online. The term podcasting, named after the iPod, appeared in 2004. In those early days, a slew of new shows popped up, and some of them have stuck around. The online magazine Slate launched a current affairs talk show called Political Gabfest in 2005, still going strong. Emily Bazelon's one of the hosts. She's also an investigative journalist and staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Raymond Tungekar sat down with her to ask how the Gabfest got started.
The Gabfest has pretty humble origins. Andy Bowers, who's the guru of all Slate podcasts and a former NPR guy, had the idea of a show with maybe a rotating cast of characters that would be the equivalent of what political pundits would talk about in the bar after the real show on TV. And so originally when it started, John and David and I weren't the regulars. It was a bunch of different people. And then it just turned out the three of us would walk to get lunch together a lot. And we just developed this kind of natural way of shooting around ideas. And eventually that translated into the studio. Although I have to say, we listened to the very first episode we did together the other day, and it was terrible.
Huh, how come?
Well, we were super stiff.
So do you find yourself actually having to, like, I mean, the thing is, you have, like, a wonderful rapport with John and David. I also wonder how much of that is kind of acting.
It's not acting. I mean, I think what we learned, if anything, from listening to that first episode was that when we were trying to kind of play the role of, like, real people who know what they're talking about, it was pretty disastrous. I sounded so humorless. And you could hear David kind of reaching for a certain phrase a little bit. And then we just, like, relaxed and treated being in the studio the same way we treat just having conversations with each other. It's very fluid. It never feels to me like it's really very different. And I think that's why the show works.
Jeb Bush kind of, sort of announced something this week. What was it, John?
He announced that he is actively going to think about having an exploratory committee. He's going to form a PAC.
He's raising money.
He's going to form a PAC to raise money.
And he's trying to shove other contenders for his fundraisers out of the way.
Right. Well,
or
yeah.
Find out he's too unpopular among the base to ever win.
Right. No. Emily's jumped ahead.
Why are you trying
story.
To jump ahead and condense the whole topic
into like
35
seconds? I was
trying
to see if John
seconds.
Thought I was right. Will yeah. gave me a big pat on the
here.
Head. Yeah.
Yeah.
Will gave me a pat on the head in the last segment. I've gotten over eager. I'll now shut up. I'm sorry.
No. I was just trying to, like, so what he's formally done there, you know, the presidential announcement.
Well, I wonder how the transition worked out for you coming from, you know, a print reporting background. Was it difficult for you to start doing something in audio? You know, this type of informal discussion?
Yeah, it's definitely a different skill. I think that there's something about the informality and the freewheeling nature of it that's very addictive or, like, very appealing for a print person. You're not measuring every word. You can kind of play around with ideas. And I've definitely let myself do that. And once in a while, I'll say something. I'll either say something that's totally stupid or I'll say it in a way that is completely stupid and basically make a fool of myself. And someone will call me on it and I'll think, like, oh, yeah, I really should have thought that through first. But honestly, if I corrected for all those bad moments, I don't think the show would be very good because I would be weighing every word. And I think for all of us, the way in which we feel free to pose questions and think things through and not be held to a standard of this is my absolutely most informed opinion, I think it's actually important that we don't hold ourselves to that standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a level of forgiveness, I think, from the audience. It's interesting. You know, I mean this in the best way possible, but the GabFest format is kind of an old idea. You know, it's just like three people talking into a microphone and sharing ideas. You know, it's the type of thing that talk radio has been doing for years. And yet, the Political GabFest is one of the most successful podcasts out there. Hundreds of thousands of listeners, 75,000 subscribers. Why do you think it's been so successful?
I have no idea. I mean, it's so nice of you to say that. I don't think any of us really know the answer to that. It has something to do, I guess, with the rapport among the three of us. Maybe it's just that we started like almost 10 years ago. We've really been doing this for a long time. Maybe we just sort of snuck into this space before a lot of other people were podcasting.
I also wonder if it's about the podcast's ability to get in the hands of a very niche audience.
Absolutely. I mean, there is an intimacy about audio, right? It's really true for how a lot of us think about our favorite NPR hosts. You feel like you've had dinner with them a million times, even though you have never met them. So I think that intimacy is really important. And then I think you're also right. Podcasts do not have to have a huge audience in like TV or even radio terms to be successes.
Mm-hmm. And one other question I have about just, it seems like with the GabFest and a lot of other podcasts, there's a level of ownership that audience members have on it. Like they can actually see, for example, with Serial, you know, you can actually see the reporting happen. It's, you feel like you're part of the whole process. I wonder if podcasts and the GabFest makes journalism both accessible and kind of humanizes it.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, one of the revelations of Serial, because I've been just completely enjoying the success of Serial and listening it to myself, but one of the revelations is that someone could actually be interested in your reporting process. As someone who does long-form magazine work, that's really reassuring.
Okay. Well, can you just walk me through like the whole process of putting a show together? Who comes up with the topics, for example?
Usually by Tuesday, David will send around an email proposing a few topics, and John and I will weigh in. Sometimes we say no, we don't like any of those. Sometimes there's no clear news in a week, and we're all sort of fishing around and looking for something. Hopefully by Wednesday, we've solidified things, and we have an amazing intern, and he has been doing these great prep memos for us. So then by Wednesday night, we have like 40 pages to read about the three stories we're going to talk about. And then sometimes, you know, news will break at the last minute. We'll just switch on a Thursday morning to something else and not be super prepared, but try to really just like jump on the news and bounce off it.
Well, what's an example of a topic that's too obvious that you had to, you know, just reconsider?
Dispatch. Let's see. Well, like, so this week we were considering whether to talk about the hostage-taking situation in Australia. And if that was unfolding over a longer period of time and we could talk about the media coverage of it or some other part of it, then that might have been interesting to us. But it's so clear this is awful and the terrorists are horrible. There's just, it's not clear what the second or third sentence is or like how to mix it up. So that's the kind of topic that we might stay away from. I think we will stay away from that this week.
When you're coming up with a topic, is there ever a point where you think to yourself, this wouldn't really work for the GabFest, I might just write about it for the New York Times instead? What types of topics lend itself towards audio versus print?
That's a good question. We do sometimes pull topics out because they just seem like they wouldn't be conversations. Like a Supreme Court case might be interesting to me, and then I'll realize in trying to sell David and John on it that it's just too in the weeds. The truth is that if I figured that out, it's probably not a good thing for me to write about anyway, but I might be stubborn and try to find some way into it in print on my own without them.
Well, I also, you know, there's been a lot of articles, especially on Slate, about how we're entering some kind of podcast renaissance. Is there a part of you that's like, I've been doing this for years?
Me? Oh, no. I'm so happy about the podcast renaissance. I mean, look, for many years, and it still happens frequently, I mention the GabFest and people have no idea what I'm talking about. And I say, oh, you know, it's this podcast. And they still don't even know that word. So then I say, well, it's like an internet radio show. It's like radio, but you can download it and listen to whatever you want. And then maybe I get nods of recognition like, oh, that sounds like not a terrible idea. But it's still not super mainstream. And so it's good for podcasting to have a bigger audience. I mean, Serial is like the best thing that happened to all of us, I would argue, for that reason. And I also am just such a fan of this medium myself that the more it takes off, like the better for me, the more great things there are to listen to.
Okay. Well, and also, last question I have to ask. Are podcasts going to kill public radio?
So what do you think about that?
I think there's going to be a period of change. Different stations will have to play around with different funding models. But I think there always will be a place for some kind of terrestrial radio-based news content.
Yeah. So I love my local NPR station and wish it only well. Here's my thing, though. I notice now that when I'm in the car and so I will turn on NPR and I'll start listening to Morning Edition or All Things Considered. But now I have my phone or my iPod with me. And if I get bored immediately, I just put in a podcast. I'm someone who's addicted to storytelling, and I love the cast of characters of the shows that I follow. And that just has more appeal to me a lot of times than listening to whatever the news report might or might not yield. So maybe this is bad for public radio. On the other hand, a lot of the best shows are coming straight from public radio. So I guess the question is, what's the financial model that will allow more of those shows to be produced without screwing things up for the local stations? But I hope there's a way to strike a balance there.
I wonder if at the same time, I mean, from a news perspective, will that type of control that audiences have, will that make it more likely that important stories that need to be out there will be overlooked?
Maybe. I mean, this is a question we're asking generally about the media, right? Whether it's become so fragmented. And so, yes, we have lost the moment, that supposed golden era where there were three networks on television and they dictated the news and big stories supposedly got their due. It seems to me that there's a lot to be said for just like lots of different flowers blooming and people picking what they want to hear. And, you know, on the internet, when a story is really, really good and interesting and original, it takes off. And it feels like, in a very democratic way, everybody hears it or reads it. Maybe it was produced by an outlet you've never heard of before. And yet you'll hear about it because someone will send it over Facebook or they'll tweet it at you, or you'll just hear other people talking about it and you'll go find it yourself. So I guess that's the like rosier view of what you're talking about. And I don't know which is more right. Probably they're both somewhat true.
That's one of the hosts of Slate's Political Gabfest, Emily Bazelon. She's also a New York Times Magazine writer. Raymond Tungekar talked with her. So if we're in the midst of a new wave of podcasting, then people are out there trying to create new kinds of programs. If they're looking for some real creative inspiration, they might want to tune into WFMU. It broadcasts over the air from Jersey City and online. Since the mid-90s, it's been an independent, listener-supported community station. You won't hear Morning Edition or the BBC. Esoteric music lovers and cultural cognoscenti are fans of WFMU's unique sound. Steve Paulson sat down with longtime station manager Ken Friedman to try to figure out what keeps FMU so original.
So Ken, for people who've never heard WFMU, can you explain what kinds of programs your station airs?
Oh boy, you hit me with the hardest question right off the bat. I mean, we play anything that makes sound found under the sun, and just about any type of recorded music going back to the 1880s to current day. Mariachi doo-wop, Edison Cylinders, EDM that's being performed live over the air, and everything in between.
So mostly music. I mean, and pretty esoteric music, but there's other stuff as well. I mean, you've got comedy programs, a show about beer making, right?
Yeah, we have actually some of our most popular programs are comedy programs. It's freeform radio, so we're allowing the individual DJs to use the radio station during their show as their own little personal canvas. It doesn't have to be music.
So what's the philosophy here? I mean, other than kind of turning it over to a very creative host?
Well, that is kind of essential to the philosophy, is to, you know, return radio to the days when it was really up to the individual DJ or the individual producer what went over the air, as opposed to management or as opposed to focus groups. So it is returning radio to the thing that I think radio is best at, which is a mass medium that can be performed spontaneously by a single individual.
You are really cutting against the grain here, is all I can say. There aren't many stations like yours anymore, are there?
There are a handful around the world. But yeah, we are cutting against the grain. And that's sort of what we want to do. That sort of is the mission of the station, is to pursue the types of ideas and the types of music and the types of sound and the types of approaches to radio that have fallen in between the cracks.
Is there anything you would not put on the air?
Other than FCC regulations and perhaps other concerns like libel and things like that, no, I can't really think of anything that we consciously avoid. At FMU also, it's not a question of us being open to all these different approaches. At FMU, the management is encouraging people to go to extremes.
Well, give me an example. I mean, I'm really interested in which shows make it. I mean, when someone, a new host, comes to you and pitches a show, what pushes that over the top, whereas something else just doesn't cut it?
Well, I mean, I'm looking for programs that are informed by what WFMU has done and yet are taking it into a different direction. I do give programs a long time to prove themselves. I really think it takes about 2 to 3 years for a radio program or a podcast to develop a following. So I like people to have the freedom to go that long, you know, before I'm judging whether they've quote-unquote made it or not.
Now, the usual way that a radio station evaluates success is you look at audience numbers, or you look at, you know, how much money the show brings in during fundraisers. Does any of that stuff matter to you?
It matters a little bit, but I'd say we probably look at a lot more factors than other radio stations. There are certain kinds of music that are favorites of people who don't have much money. So you can't just look at money. You know, like hip-hop and West Indian music in the New York area, those appeal to less affluent audiences. So it would be unfair to me to have the same expectation of a program like hip-hop or West Indian music that I have for another kind of music that has a very affluent audience. But I am looking at programs that are connecting with people. How much they raise during the pledge drive is one bit of evidence, but there's plenty of other types of evidence that I look at as well, including the activity that happens on the phone or during chat boards while the program is going on, the activity surrounding that program in forms of social media, things like that.
And how do you know if a show is not working? I mean, can you give me an example of something that you thought was going to make it and it just never really took off?
Well, I don't want to name names, but I have on occasion tried to take podcasts that I really loved and tried to turn them into WFMU radio programs. And that doesn't work because compared to everything else around them on the weekly schedule, you can tell that they're just being done on a recorded basis, you know, in a bedroom or a garage somewhere. It just doesn't have that live, spontaneous feel. So that's taken me a while to figure out. But I think more than any other station, we are about the form of live, spontaneous, human radio.
Why is that so important to you, live radio?
Live human radio is really important because it tends to excite people. People really respond to it and really love it. And if you look back at the history of radio broadcasting, this is the kind of radio that's built big community and that's like been in the middle of movements. It's been the spontaneous human radio, and it's being lost. It's being lost because algorithms are dictating more and more what people listen to in terms of music on the internet. Automation is controlling more and more radio stations. Mainstream public radio tends to follow a really similar format anywhere it exists in North America. So the spontaneous human element, which to me was always the greatest thing about radio, is being lost.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about your station, FMU, is, I mean, you've got a huge reputation in some circles, you know, among sort of those in the know in the music and culture scene. But my understanding is that all your hosts work for free. And in fact, there's huge competition to try to, you know, get a spot on the air. How does that work?
Yeah, almost all of our DJs do work for free. We have one paid person who works Monday through Friday mornings drive time. At this point, there's no point in me extolling the philosophy behind this, which I could do, but we just can't afford to pay people. We can't even, we can barely afford to operate the way we're operating now. The upside of everybody being here for free means that they're here because they love it. They're here because they're really dedicated to doing it. It's a filter that tends to work really well. And in fact, a big chunk of our staff are people who work in radio or music or audio in some other form, but then they come to WFMU because of the freedom of expression and the fact that this to them is, you know, the pure form of radio and music that they get to pursue.
Now, there is another emerging model doing podcasts. And I know, in fact, that, you know, a number of your shows are starting to branch out not just as broadcast programs, but also as podcasts. Is that a viable model?
Yeah, it would appear that it is a viable model. And we do have two really great programs that have left FMU and are now pursuing monetized podcasts in two completely different ways. But yeah, certainly a lot of people have managed to do that, which is great. I'm really happy that's an option for programs that do become popular enough and really connect with people.
Well, let me ask you about one of your most popular hosts, Tom Sharpling, who recently left to start his own podcast. Was that basically because he wanted to make some money doing what he had been doing for free?
Yeah, but it goes beyond that because his program had become such a phenomenon that just dealing with the huge popularity that he had, even beyond the massive amounts of preparation that he did for every week's show, it just became a full-time job for him. And I couldn't ever possibly pay him a full-time salary. Meanwhile, the popularity of his show had inspired so many other comedy podcasts that had become monetized that it was very frustrating for him to see that. So I think, you know, the program and its popularity just took a natural course. and I don't have any regrets. I'm really happy and excited for Tom, and I'm helping him however I can.
Can you see that happening with some of your other hosts as well, that they leave to do their own podcast and hopefully to make some money doing it?
Yeah, it's already happened with one other DJ, Benjamin Walker, who's part of Roman Mars's Radiotopia podcasting conglomerate. And I could definitely see it happening with other DJs in the future. But not to the degree that it creates a problem for FMU internally, though.
Do you see podcasts as competition for radio? I mean, not just for your station, but just more generally as an industry kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, podcasting is definitely competing for people's listening time. Aesthetically, I find podcasting still to be kind of a different thing than what I think our strength is. Podcasting still tends to sound pre-recorded. It's very hard for me to exactly put my finger on what it is. I still think there's a very different kind of feeling of community and family and companionship that you get from a live human-run radio station.
So it sounds like you're saying that chances are WFMU will sound pretty much the way it does now 5 or 10 years from now, even if podcasting kind of sweeps the rest of the media.
Yeah, there's a very good chance that it will. I mean, I think that we're definitely into embracing all sorts of new technology and new media, and we're always doing insane experiments, you know, trying to push the envelope of what radio is and what radio can be. But always at the core of that is this live, spontaneous human element.
Ken Friedman is the station manager and program director for WFMU. They do podcast a bunch of their shows. You can find a link to them and a list of all the other programs we've been talking about this hour on our website. That's ttbook.org. Coming up, we're moving on from podcasts. In the wake of the attack at the offices of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, we're revisiting an interview we did with Danish political cartoonist Kurt Westergaard. He lived in hiding after his life was threatened over his cartoons about the Prophet Muhammad.
It is an absurd thought that you have got to be partly underground in your own country where you have done nothing wrong. I have just defended a Danish tradition, a satirical tradition in the fields of freedom of speech.
Stay with us. I'm Sarah Nix. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Sam Scheffler. I'm a philosophy professor at New York University, and I'm the author of Death and the Afterlife. The book I would like to recommend is P.D. James's novel, The Children of Men, which is a beautifully written and very vivid and gripping novel about life in England in the year 2021. In a situation where the human race has come face to face with its own extinction. What's absolutely brilliant about P.D. James's novel is that she asks us to imagine a situation in which the human race has become infertile. No new babies have been born in over 25 years, and so humanity is gradually dying out, it's gradually aging, just because no new babies are being born. And so we ourselves, if we inhabit her world, we're not going to die prematurely, and none of our loved ones is going to die prematurely. All that's going to happen is that no new people are going to come into existence. by making that the premise of her novel, James forces us very effectively and very powerfully to focus on the meaning of human survival as such for us. I read it because I first saw the film that was made in 2006 based on the novel, and I was quite struck by that idea, by the strength of people's reactions as depicted in the film to the prospect of humanity's imminent disappearance. But I then went and read the book, and I found the book even more powerful, considerably more powerful. And I think that my overwhelming reaction was just one of tremendous sadness and really gloom at the idea of humanity disappearing. And accompanying that was a sense of some puzzlement. Why exactly was this so powerful? After all, by the terms of her novel, nobody has to die any earlier than they otherwise would. It's just no new people are going to be born. And why does that affect one so much? We're accustomed to being deeply affected by the births and deaths of family members and friends and people we care about and are personally attached to. But this isn't like that. This is just about the non-existence of future strangers, and that should have such a deep and obvious and immediate emotional impact is itself a source of fascination.
Samuel Scheffler recommends The Children of Men by P.D. James. You'll find more bookmarks plus an interview with Scheffler on our website, ttbook.org. The 12 people who died during the attack on the Charlie Hebdo office are on our minds this week. Most of the victims were cartoonists for the French satirical weekly. Its reporters and editors had often received death threats for the magazine's depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. A hit list that was published in an Al-Qaeda magazine in 2013 also named Danish cartoonist Kurt Vestergaard. Steve Paulson talked with him a few years ago while Vestergaard was living in hiding in Denmark.
We have just moved to safe house number 9. We are still on the road, I suppose, and you never get used to that. But it is an absurd thought that you have got to be partly underground in your own country where you have done nothing wrong. I have just defended a Danish tradition, a satirical tradition in the fields of freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me take you back to the cartoon that you drew a couple of years ago, which was probably the most controversial of all the Danish cartoons. This was the one of the Prophet Muhammad with a bomb in his turban. First of all, can you describe that cartoon?
Yes. You see a man with a black beard, and then he has a turban, and in the turban is a bomb, and on the turban is a description, the traditional Arabian description, something like there is only one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. This cartoon is made because of my anger and my shock after the 9/11 events in New York and also the other bombings that has taken place, Madrid, London. And I think the cartoon depicts that there are terrorists who get their spiritual ammunition from an interpretation of the religion Islam. Or you can say that the terrorists, they have taken Muhammad, the prophet, as a hostage.
So you had no idea that this cartoon, not only the one that you did, but the other Danish cartoons about Muhammad, would cause such a furor around the world. I mean, to the point where there were riots in many countries and dozens, if not 100 people died in those riots directly as a result of these Danish cartoons.
Yes, and I'm very sorry that people were killed in these riots, but I can take no responsibility for that, because these demonstrations, after my opinion, were staged by the regimes who cannot fulfill their population's needs. So such a demonstration is for some time able to divert the population's attention from the miserable conditions of living.
So you're saying that people, maybe politicians in particular, use these cartoons as an excuse to mobilize people against the West, against these cartoons in particular. It wasn't just a spontaneous response.
No. I think these demonstrations were staged by the regimes. I'm quite sure of that. Also, in the future, this Muhammad crisis may pop up again when it is useful for certain political forces in the Middle East. So it will not stop.
But considering the revered status that the Prophet Muhammad has within Islam for Muslims around the world, why not treat him with more respect? You must have known that suggesting that Muhammad himself was a terrorist, I mean, by drawing this cartoon with a bomb in his turban, that you would infuriate a lot of people. Why go ahead and do that?
Because part of Islam is, after my opinion, evil. It is intolerant. I don't speak about the whole Islam, but there are parts of this religion which is intolerant and evil. And this branch of Islam produces those terrorists and their terrible and cruel acts. I think it's a job for the bureaucrats of the religion. That means the priests, the imams, transform the religion because they have the power to do it and they have the authority to do it. We say that God created man in his own picture, but I think it's the opposite. I think that man creates God in his picture.
But don't you need to distinguish between moderate Muslims who don't support violence at all, and certainly this is most the vast majority of Muslims around the world, and those radical Muslims who do resort to terrorism? I think maybe that's the distinction that a lot of people didn't see in the cartoons that you and the others did.
Even if the cartoon was evil against the whole Islam, anyway, according to the Danish tradition, have the right to make such a cartoon. There's nobody above criticism and satire, not the Queen, not the Prime Minister, not the politicians, and of course also not religion. That is the Danish tradition, and if people want to live here with us and they shall be welcome, then they have to accept our satirical traditions. There is nothing in Denmark that is holy and above satire and criticism. We like it that way.
That's Danish political cartoonist Kurt Westergaard talking with Steve Paulson. At the time, Westergaard was living in hiding at a safe house in Denmark. That's it for this hour. To the best of our knowledge, comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. The team includes Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Steve Mullen of Walk West Music created our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Anne Strainshamps is out this week. I'm Sarah Nix. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.